Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast, named after the fictional small town found in several of author Michael DeCamp's books. This podcast explores anything related to creativity. You'll hear interviews with creative people, such as authors, artists, performers, and entrepreneurs, sprinkled with friendly banter about any number of topics, all of which attempt to view the world through the lens of creativity. Turn up the volume and enjoy the latest conversations in Cutter's Notch.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Cutter's Notch podcast. I'm your host, Michael DeCamp, and I'm here with my co-host,
Nancy DeCamp. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Michael.
And with us today is a new friend of mine, another fellow author who is a Hoosier. He lives on the east side of the state. I won't give away his address, but I met him recently. We worked an event together at the Christmas Gift and Hobby Show. I picked up his book there and really liked it. In fact, I've mentioned it in the last couple of episodes. So we have a treat today in that we're going to have a chat with Lloyd Mullins, the author of A Rare and Dangerous Beast.
Hello, Hi, Lloyd.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. It's great to have you here.
It's good to be here. I'm glad I got here.
Yeah. Lloyd drove through the snow and the cold.
It's snowing today.
Yeah. It's Indiana and it's January.
Well, it used to take an hour and a half, took like two and a half or something.
Yeah, it was stupid.
But here you are, and we'll see how long you have to stay.
What dedication. We do have a spare room. We might have to put the blankets on, you know.
The snow seems to be stopping. So
it looked that way to me a little bit ago.
Get it cleared up. Yeah. Some.
You got a good podcasting voice.
Oh.
I'll just say nice, deep voice. So
isn't that better than what they always used to say? You have a face for radio.
Well,
I got that covered too.
So, as always, we'll get into a discussion with Lloyd about his book and his works around that in just a few minutes. But we want to start off with our creative indulgences. And as I usually do, I hit Nancy with it first. What's your creative indulgence, Nancy?
You know, and I don't remember if I shared this on the last podcast. And I was sitting here thinking, oh gosh, he's going to ask me to go first. And what have I been doing in a career from a creative perspective? But I will say I tend to do this a lot, but it's explore recipes. And I've been looking at more plant-based recipes. I'm not going all vegetarian and vegan, but I'm very interested in more high nutritional foods that are come, you know, not out of a box, but actual straight from, you know, farm to table kind of thing. And so, I've been experimenting with that some, and some of the things I've liked and some of them have been like, meh, but I would say that's been my creative indulgence recently has been looking at plant-based meals.
And I'm along for the creative ride.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I enjoy the ride. Sometimes not so much.
What about you, Mike?
What, me?
Yeah. Have you had a creative indulgence recently?
Well, yeah. I had a couple of things I could share, but I think one of the things, we just came out of the holiday season, and one of the things we like to do as a family is jigsaw puzzles.
And
we actually nailed down two of them, two pretty good sized jigsaw puzzles within a week. The first one, man, it just flew down.
It was fun. It was a fun one.
And that's not counting the Advent ones we did before Christmas.
Yeah, we had a friend gift us, and then we had another, it was an Advent puzzle in the sense that every day you got a few pieces to put together throughout the, you know, month of December or whatever.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
We did those. And then we had, I guess, one that I got for Christmas. I mean, or was that the last one we just did?
No.
No. Okay.
The one
I got. And then we just did another one.
Yeah.
And the last one was the hardest.
Yeah.
It was definitely the hardest. But we knocked them back in about a week. And frankly, I got addicted.
You did. He was quite obsessed with the second one. I was like, you know, I wouldn't mind putting a piece or two in there myself.
Well, I'd start to go to bed at like 11 o'clock or something. And I'm like, well, maybe I'll put in a couple of pieces. And I'd sit down and next thing I know, it's 1:30 in the morning. It's like, oh man, I'm not going to get enough sleep tonight. But hey, we nailed it back. It was fun. And that's our, we'll put those puzzles away and we probably won't do another one until next December.
Probably. I got one more I might pull out. It's a long winter. So I'm not going to do it right away, but you know.
I got a, it's behind you, Nancy.
Oh,
in,
yeah.
In the studio here, but I got a 3D nightlight puzzle.
Yeah. You need to put that together.
I guess I got to do that. Lloyd, what about you? Creative indulgence.
I'm trying out podcasts. I'd never listened to one because I could never figure out how. And then I heard about this one. I can't remember the guy's name. Anyway, it's called Countdown to Armageddon, Hardcore History.
Ooh. Oh, interesting.
Countdown to Armageddon. And it's about World War One.
Oh, wow.
And it's like six episodes. It's like 18 hours total. And so I've been listening to that, and that's really, really good.
Yeah.
You know, and World War One is one of those that I think, I don't know about most people. I think most people probably don't know a lot about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know a lot about it. And I know, you know, kind of the basics and stuff like that, but I've been reading a lot of like World War One stuff,
yeah,
you know, and things like that. So I'm finding that really interesting. So.
That is interesting.
And you're kind of a history buff, aren't you?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, which brings us right back around to what you're doing here.
Yes. So, why is he here today, Mike?
He's here because I read his book and I really liked it.
What's the name of that book?
A Rare and Dangerous Beast.
He told me he thought I might. I tend to like historical fiction. He was commenting as Mike read through the book. He was commenting. He doesn't always do that. So
okay. Yeah. So Nancy needs to read it.
Yeah, I need to.
I think everybody should, really.
Well, you know.
Sure. Why not?
You know,
what else are you doing this winter? If you don't have a jigsaw puzzle, you need a break or,
yeah. You know, I think there are two books that every human being should read. One is A Rare and Dangerous Beast, and the other one is The Purveyor of Death.
That sounds like a great plan.
By Michael DeCamp.
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, so.
Absolutely.
There, I got my shameless plug in.
There you go.
All right, so Lloyd, tell us about the story in that book. Give us the 30,000 foot view of what this book is.
Okay. It's about a guy who comes to America as a kid. He's half Russian, half Buryat Mongol. And he's basically, he's on the run from the Russian law and comes to America with his sister and or his brother and half sister. And they came into California during the gold rush. And then it's basically a 40 year odyssey of his through the old West, trying to just be free and figure out what freedom in America means. And it's kind of a little guy's look at the old West, you know, the people who don't have any power. He has a lot of sympathy for them. His father was a Decembrist, a revolutionary in Russia. And so he grew up being told about the American founding fathers and taught enlightenment philosophy and all that kind of stuff. And America is like, you know, a big deal to them. And so he comes here with really high hopes and high expectations and then learns that, you know, as he goes through his life, he starts seeing the power struggles that are going on and being a foreigner, and, you know, half Mongol, he doesn't fit anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, he's constantly being mistaken for some other race, you know. It's a hard book to describe, really.
Yeah.
It sounds very interesting already, what you're telling me. Just
the
life story, you know.
That's the thing that struck me as, you know, it started in Russia, the Mongol region, Buryat region of Russia. Which I don't know anything about that. Buryat.
It's basically Siberia near Lake Baikal.
Okay.
They live like the Buryats live like east of Baikal, and the Russians, the town of Irkutsk, which is where he grows up, is west of Baikal. And so his mom's Buryat. And so he would like spend summers with his mom's people and learn to ride and shoot and all that kind of stuff. And then in the winters, he was home with his folks and got the Western civilization, literature and
more of the learning and culture, the
learning and book learning and stuff that philosophy and things like that.
Yeah.
And so kind of, he's like growing up, putting those two things
together. Kind of a Renaissance man.
Sort of, yeah, I think so.
But then he gets in trouble, and guess what it was? It was a girl. He got he got in trouble over a girl.
Oh, yeah. Man, yeah. So I hate when that happens.
He had to flee.
Yeah. Because one of the interesting
things happen.
Well, one of the interesting things, because I was trying to figure out, I wanted them to be an outsider because I've got him mixing with, you know, Cheyenne Indians and Nez Perce Indians and, yeah, and white, you know, cowboys and ranchers and law and stuff like that. And so I wanted him to be able to kind of fit in everywhere, but still not really belong.
You know, it's you say the Nez Perce, because when Mike was reading this, he goes, didn't you? I said, yeah, I read a whole book about Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce and, you know, what all happened with them.
When they were fleeing.
When they were fleeing.
What book was it? Do you remember?
No. I think it's just Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce or something,
something
like that.
We something it up, simple like that. We picked it up when we were out at Yellowstone area, right? Yeah,
picked it up in Yellowstone. In
fact, there are a lot of books about him.
Here's an idea for you. You might pitch this to the people who supply the books at Yellowstone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've thought about a lot of things. I'm not good at marketing.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. I'm like, what the hell, man?
Authors are often great at writing and terrible at marketing.
I thought the writing was going to be the hard part. That was the easy part.
Yeah. Right.
And that was like pulling teeth. So, you know, this whole marketing thing, I'm like, oh no.
So what, let me just back it up. So we know what the book's about a little bit, but what motivated you to write this book?
I grew up really conservative. You know, I mean, we had a tree farm and, you know, my dad was a hardcore Democrat, but he was also very conservative. He was a weird mix. It's like he loved unions, refused to belong to one.
Okay.
Because the union would tell you how you could work and when you could work and stuff like that. And so he didn't want anything to do with that, but he was a strong supporter of unions.
Right.
So he was kind of a paradoxical kind of guy, you know, but that whole patriotic growing up on John Wayne movies
and
Sands of Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And then I was spent 20 years in the Air Force.
Okay. And thank you for your service. I know it's not always the greatest experience, but I do appreciate your.
Well, thanks. That's, again, a very conservative, militaristic mindset, you know. And then when I got out of the service, I found out that I suck at making a living. there's no civilian equivalent for my job. I spent like 10 years I spent like a year and a half delivering campers. Basically living in my truck, you know, and working retail. And
were you working for Tom Raper?
No, I was working for like one of the manufacturers.
Okay.
You know, and
for those listeners out there who don't know, or if you're like in Seattle or somewhere, there used to be way out east in Indiana, an exit. Was it 141 or whatever it is?
Something like
149.
Yeah.
Exit 149A. Yeah. And they had this ginormous RV store, and it was the Tom Raper RVs. And
lots of marketing there.
Oh, my goodness. Now, it's still there, but it's changed hands. It's not the same. It's
kind a camping of, world it's or a camper camping, world camper, or whatever.
Camper's world.
So anyway, back to your story you doing a lot of different things.
And so I had a heart attack about 10 years after I got out of the service. And I thought, okay, I've got, because I was driving a school bus at the time, and that was just stressing me out.
See, there's another reason why I don't want to do that.
That's, Mike's been talking about doing a part-time job recently. Man, we were talking. I was like, what about being a school bus driver? And he's like, yeah.
And the thing is, like, the kids on my bus weren't that bad.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the guys at my church drives a school bus. He loves it.
Yeah.
You know, and I just.
It's a lot of responsibility.
I couldn't deal with it, you know, and that contributed to the heart attack, I think. And I'm like, okay, I got to do something else.
Yeah.
You know, and then I figured out, okay, I could go to college. They would actually pay me to go to college on the GI Bill.
Sure.
So I'm like, okay, well, that defers the whole, what am I going to do when I grow up for another 4 years?
Right.
So I started going to college, and it's like, okay, I was 48 at the time.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be starting a new career.
Right, right.
You know,
I'm not going to climb that corporate ladder.
Yeah. So I'm like, I'm going to study what I want to study. And I've always loved to read.
Yeah.
You know, and so I wanted to study literature and English and that kind of stuff. So I did that for 4 years. And even at IU East, which is a little, you know, like branch school in Richmond.
Sure.
Which is a relatively small town. I had to like interact with a lot of people that who I was complete sorts of people that I was very, very unfamiliar with. You know, and then of course some, and then some of the courses that I took were like the history is, or I had to take a Spanish class, a Spanish culture class. So I took that, and it, a lot of it was just about American interventionism in South America and Central America. And I was like, and this was all stuff that it's like, I was vaguely aware of, but I didn't really know a lot about. And so, and I still don't know a lot about it, but you know, I did some, you know, this study.
Been introduced to it.
Yeah. And I'm like, that's not great, you know? And so that was like on my mind. And then I read just in like a fairly rapid succession, like two books on the Nez Perce and George Bent's biography, and or well, not quite an autobiography, but, and then a book on the Johnson County War. You know, and I was pretty familiar with the Cheyenne War. And so George Bent helped with that and stuff like that. So I started thinking, it's like, you know, and I didn't know a whole lot about the gold rush other than there was gold involved. So I thought, that's why I don't deal with that a whole lot. I deal with that kind of tangentially in the book. And I thought, you know, one dude could have gone through all of this, you know? And it was, well, and like the Civil War. And I have read a lot about the Civil War, but never really the New Mexico campaign, which was about all the Civil War in the West amounted to. And that was really interesting, you know? And so I thought, you know, this dude, if he came to California, and one of the other things that I liked was the idea of having him come to California from a foreign country rather than the East Coast.
Right.
Because almost every immigrant story you hear about.
Ellis Island.
Or even before that, you know, coming into New York or Savannah or whatever. And then, you know, the wagon train and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's, that story has been told 1,000 times. So I want to just like stick him right in there.
Right.
So I did.
So he comes into San Francisco and eventually migrates more toward like the Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico. He's, you know, he's kind of all over that kind of central part.
Yeah. He, well, he goes, he, the, there's a strike up in Shasta, California, which is up north. And so he goes up there to try mining. His idea, because he's 15, 16 years old. Yeah. He's like, okay, I'll go up there. I'll mine for a couple of years, make my fortune, you know, get my brother and sister set up and, you know, and just kick back and relax because he's very naive, you know? And so that doesn't really work out. And it turns out he's not cut out for mining. And then he accidentally kind of becomes a cowboy, you know, and I've always loved the whole cowboy thing when I was a kid. When I grow up, I want to be a cowboy.
We
always
like, we have a kind of a ongoing thing that Saturdays are for cowboy movies.
And
we haven't really watched one for a while.
We haven't for a while, but it that has been a pretty common theme throughout our marriage. And
here's a tangent. What's your favorite cowboy movie?
Probably The Wild Bunch.
Oh, mine is The Outlaw Josie Wales.
That's like my number two. It's like we used to, when I was on Diego Garcia during the first Gulf War, we would sit around because it was really dull and there were no women there. Well, basically same as no women there.
Yeah.
And so we would sit around and just make top 10 lists and argue about what should be on it. And Westerns was one of
them. Westerns was one of them.
Top 10 greatest Westerns.
And
so we'd argue about your favorite Western.
A Bend in the River.
Yeah. Jimmy Stewart.
It's a Jimmy Stewart one.
Yeah. That was one of the Michael Mann ones, wasn't it?
I don't know.
I don't remember Michael Mann's name.
Well, he was a director.
Yeah. I'll look it up. She'll check it out while we're chatting. Yeah,
I really like the, you know, with Clint Eastwood, a lot of people really like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I wasn't a big fan of that movie, but I like this. There's a trilogy. It's not really connected, but to me, it's the top three for me of Eastwood movies, and I'm going to give them in order.
Yeah.
So The Outlaw Josie Wales, Unforgiven, and Pale Rider, my three favorite Eastwood movies. So anyway, that's that was a tangent.
Yep. Sorry. Director Anthony Mann.
Okay.
So you're on it there.
Anthony Mann. Okay.
Yeah. Well, okay. I'll back up for a second. Aside from your story, what motivated you to write a book? Did you just, was it your education or you just felt like you had it in you?
I when I was a kid, I wanted to grow up and be, because it turned out I'm not great with horses. So Cowboy was pretty much out.
Yeah.
And I can't swim. So Pirate was out.
Wow. Shoot.
So yeah, I was like, oh crap, man. I gotta maybe writer. Cause I love to read and I like telling stories.
And you've always been a reader.
Oh yeah. I remember when I was in the first grade, I had to get a note from my mom so that I could check out a book by Dee Brown about Custer's Last Stand because it was too advanced for me.
Oh, you know? I love that.
And so I use that note a lot, you know, but, and actually when I made my research trip for this book, I found it at the Little Bighorn.
That's a cool place. We did a trip out west and I was like, we have to go there. We're going to take the trip to go over there.
Yeah.
That is impressive to see and think about how the battle played out. Were you actually physically there and see?
Yeah.
And the ravines and of that.
That was the site of the first fight me and my wife ever had.
Really?
Oh yeah.
I was going to shift gears for a minute, but now you got us
interested. We had our first fight in Muncie, Indiana.
Yep. Potato chips and cherry coke
fight.
Yeah,
it's been known for us forever.
Yeah, it's famous for in our circles. So your first fight
was at Custer's. That's kind of iconic.
Could have been Lloyd's Last Stand.
It was very close. She was ready to murder. Well, we'd already been married for I think about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah,
you made it 4 or 5 years before your first real fight.
Wow,
see, I was
that's impressive.
My first marriage was not good.
Okay,
and so the second time around, I'm like, I need to spend a lot of time sucking up to her because I'm only doing this. This is the last time I'm doing this. So, and she's very easygoing and she's awesome. You know, she's a better person, a better situation.
Than
I am. Yeah. So anyway, my oldest daughter had come to live with us and her nephew had come out and they were both about 14. And so we were going to take this big trip out west and just, you know, because we were living in Vegas. So we're going to just drive around and go to Yellowstone and Black Hills and all that. And so I had been wanting to go to the Little Bighorn since forever.
First grade with that little paper from mom to get the book or whatever.
Well, actually before that, because I remember watching, there was a time period there where Custer of the West, which was a Robert Shaw movie. Mm-hmm. And I loved Robert Shaw and I loved Custer and all that because I was young and naive and ignorant. And I loved that movie. So it was like before I ever started school, I loved that whole thing. So I'd been looking forward to it for about 35 years. And so we get there and we drive up and we get the little tape and we go and we drive around the battlefield and all that. And it's like, we're there, you know, half an hour, you know, 45 minutes, something like that, long enough to listen to the tapes and all that. And then we drive across the road to the
Center
restaurant thing
place.
There.
Yeah.
And we eat and Jess is like, so what do you want to do now? And I'm like, what do you mean? What do I want to do now? We got to go back. It's like, well, we've been there. I'm like, no, I know that doesn't count. That was just a preview, you know? And cause she's not as much into history and all that kind of stuff as I was. And the kids were definitely not into
at that age
and all that. And so I was like, she wanted to go back to the campground and like go swimming and stuff like that. Take the dogs out and to the river and things like that. And so basically she wanted to leave me there to do my sightseeing and she would come back and get me. And I wanted her to leave me there and go do what she wanted to do and come back. But we weren't communicating that very well. And we were just like, rawr, rawr, you know, and it never got real ugly, but it was touch and go.
It was a I think that's kind of cool that you had your first big fight at Little Bighorn. that's kind of cool.
Yeah. We had a really big one at the Grand Canyon. Most of the fights that Nancy and I have had are wrapped around something really stupid that I've said.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah. Sometimes I open my mouth and out comes stuff that gets me in a lot of trouble. So, you know, one of the things I liked about your book, you know, I found intriguing, or it was a thread, was this girlfriend.
Esme.
Yes.
Yes.
Where did that idea come from? Esme is an intriguing individual.
Yeah, I basically dated her for a fairly brief time after my divorce. You know, and she was a great girl. We were just two very screwed up people trying to pull our lives together. You know, much like the situation there in Denver, you know, after the Civil War. And, you know, and it didn't work out, but she's like one of probably wildly politically incorrect to like rate women, but she's, you know, top three or four, you know? So I still wonder sometimes, it's like, I wonder what she's up to, but it's like, probably better not to know. You
better not check that out.
Yeah. So, you know, but like I said, I still think fondly of her.
Sure.
And she, I mean, for all the damage we did to each other, she still helped me through a really hard time. So, and she was just, she was like that. She was very much her own person, you know, and very kind of hard headed and like Esme in the book, you know.
You'll like Esme, Nancy.
Will I identify with Esme?
I don't know that you'll identify with her, but you will like her.
Okay.
I think
I'm looking forward to getting to know her.
She is a strong woman.
Well, I like strong women.
Put it that way.
I don't like little wimpy milk toasts, whatever. Yeah. They're all, you know what? They're all loved and beautiful, mm-hmm. but I tend to hang with the
tough ones. She's a Muay Thai kickboxer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So tell me about your research process. So you get this idea, you have this concept, you got a lot of Western detail in there. Mm-hmm. And I know that from talking to you that you put a lot of time, I heard you talking to people when they were looking at your book about how much research that you put into it. Mm-hmm. Share with that. Tell us a little bit about your research process.
Well, in a way I've been like researching this
my whole life,
you know. But yeah, when I decided to write the book, cause like I said, what put the idea in my head was the books that I had read. And then it's like, okay, well, I need to know more about this. So, you know, the Civil War, the New Mexico campaign in particular. So I kind of like bought biographies of like Ned Wynkoop and Silas Soule. And I found a book by, the guy was named Ovando Hollister, who was in the 1st Colorado Cavalry through the New Mexico campaign. And so I read that just to get details. And I wanted to keep it as close to nonfiction as I could, you know, while still having the freedom with, you know, the fictional main characters to play around with it a little bit, you know, and look at it from a different sort of lens. So I read that and it's like, and I found some, you know, websites and, you know, history websites and things like that, where I found like rosters for the 1st Colorado Cavalry. And so the names of the, like his friends in the army, even though the characters are fictional, they're still named for guys who were in that regiment.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and it's like, even like Frenchie, I don't know if the guy was French or not, but his name was, can't remember what Frenchie's name was now. Anyway, he's got a French name. I'm like, you know, that would be, he could be French. He could have fought in the Crimean War.
There you go.
Which is something else that I learned about reading historical fiction, or started learning about reading historical fiction. And so, you know, most of the characters are named for, if they're not based on, because some people you just don't know anything about other than their name on a list.
Right.
But they're named for those people anyway.
Interesting.
You know, so that was a lot of fun. It was complicated. It complicated things kind of unnecessarily, I think, you know, because
you got too much information.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, and I was writing this for my MFA thesis.
Okay.
Because I got into the MFA program in Miami so that I would write the book. Because I was like, okay, I already knew it was going to be four parts, four semesters. That's one part per semester. No problem, you know. Didn't quite work out that way, but pretty close. And so I read a lot of books, and I was, and I don't want to get into like stereotypes and things like that, but I have spent a lot of time on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation with the Lakota Sioux. And so I'm kind of familiar with kind of they think a little bit differently, you know, and
mindset,
and
just culture,
yeah, and culture, yeah. And, you know, and things like that. And I think those are probably things that are probably fairly, just like European people all think alike. They all hate each other, but they all pretty much think alike too, you know? And so it's kind of, I figure it's probably pretty much the same thing, you know, just trying to be as accurate as I could without really knowing. And so then I decided that what I needed to do, because I'm not great at describing things, you know? And so I thought, you know what I need to do? Cause we were going out to Pine Ridge. And I thought, you know, what would be really cool is once we're finished on the reservation, just I'm out there. I might as well just go around and look at these places, yeah. You know? So yeah. Me and my buddy drove from Pine Ridge. We drove down to Sand Creek and had a heck of a time finding that. Oh, that was one of the other books that I read that kind of went into the mix the guy could have lived through this too. So, went down to Sand Creek and then we drove up to Wallowa, Oregon, and followed the Nez Perce Trail through from there to Bear Paw mm-hmm. in Montana, mm-hmm. or as closely as we could. And that, it was awesome, but it was a little bit harrowing a couple of times.
Incredible territory.
Oh yeah.
Incredible territory.
We found a trail that it's basically as close as I can tell, it is the Lolo Trail that the Nez Perce would use to travel across the Bitterroot yeah. Mountains. And we drove that in my truck. Mm. It was terrifying.
I bet.
You know, because the yeah. trail is, it's like my driveway.
Yeah, yeah. This is not like a paved road. This is, and especially when you get out there in the mountainous areas. Mm-hmm.
It's two tracks. It's like I said, it's like my driveway, you know, with brush falling over it and stuff like that. Yeah. And it's like, I got vertigo.
Oh no.
And I was sitting on the inside.
Yeah.
You know, but I'd look out the passenger side window quickly because there's a lot of twists and hairpin turns and stuff.
Yeah.
And there was nothing. There was, you know, and my friend Dave, awesome dude, he was like just miserable because there was as much sky below us as there was above.
Oh my gosh.
And it was
that
just
makes me nervous just hearing about terrifying. It.
And I mean, my truck, it turns like a battleship.
Yeah.
So it's like, man, this could go really bad. Yeah. You know, yeah. but I feel like that was one of the things that I managed to describe pretty well.
Yeah. Experience.
Not
yeah.
so much what it looked like, but what it felt like.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and so.
Well, that's almost as good as describing what it looks like. I think you're trying to evoke feelings in your reader. Mm-hmm. And if you can express the feelings that mm-hmm. your characters are experiencing, I think that evokes that. So
yeah,
that's excellent.
And then we had another adventure where we were like, when we got down off the out of the Bitterroot Mountains, there was the long way around, which was quicker. And then there was the short way, which was closest to the trail that they used. So I thought, well, let's take that. And it's a gravel road. That's like, I don't know how long it is. We got about halfway across it and blew out a tire.
Oh no.
So we're like, oh, that's not great. So my friend Dave's jacking up the truck yeah. and I go get the spare tire. I'm like, where's the spare tire?
Uh-oh.
Oh no. And the winch thing that would hold the tire up had rusted off basically. And so I had the spare tire in the back of the truck and then I was hauling gravel. So I took the spare tire out and put it in the barn so I could haul the gravel. And then I forgot to put it back.
Oh like, no.
So, so you're here, you're up in this mountain pass and you got a flat tire with no spare.
Yeah. Well, fortunately we were down on the flat.
Oh, you were down.
We were down on the prairie now, okay. by now, but it's like, and then like 5 minutes later, like this family comes along on vacation and they're like, you need a hand. I was like, oh, I need more than a hand. And so they're like, well, you know, we can take you to a tire store. So the nearest tire store was about 50 miles away.
Oh my gosh.
So we get there and they just dropped me off and then took off. Cause I was pretty sure they were tired of me by then. And so I'm like, I'm getting that tire and I bought a new rim and an extra tire. Cause I'm not going through this again. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, how am I going to get back there? Cause I'm not even sure where there is.
Yeah. Where's the Uber driver?
Yeah. So I'm like, I tried calling Uber. I'd never used Uber before. So I had to like download the app and all that. And, you know, obviously I'm not, well, as you guys know, I'm not a tech guy. There is no Uber out there. Right. So I tried like Hertz Rent-A-Car and I didn't have a credit card. So they wouldn't rent me anything. I tried and it turned out I did actually have a credit card. I just didn't know I did. I tried, U-Haul, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And nothing. I was getting nowhere. And I couldn't get hold of Dave, my buddy, who'd stayed with the truck.
Yeah.
You know. And so I was like, oh, man. So I'm like texting him just to let him know that I had found someplace. And I don't know if he ever got those or not. But finally, the tire store guy is like, Hey, you know what? I take my kids up in that area snowmobiling in the winter, so I'm familiar with it, so I can give you a ride. I'm like, that's awesome. He says, but I can't do it until after we close.
Oh, no.
So I wait and wait and wait and wait and wait. And the hardest thing about that was that I didn't have my book with me, you know. So finally it closes. We load my tires in his truck, and we drive up there, and we're wandering around. And finally, we don't find Dave, but we find somebody who had seen him and the truck and pointed us down the right road. So we get down there, and the tire dude is awesome. He's got his, you know, like air hammer gun thing. Just zip, 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 gets the tire on, and it's like, okay, let's go. We take off, and he's behind us. And like 10 minutes down the road, bam, blow out the other spare. Blow out the other back tire. Like, that's not great. So, you know, fortunately, the guy was like right there. So we zipped that one on there. And we were, the original plan was we were going to drive through Yellowstone Park following the way they went.
Right.
You know, and it's like now it's like getting dark. It's like, that's not going to be good, you know. And it was during COVID, so trying to find a hotel was hard.
Very limited, yeah.
So it's like, okay, we need to just skip around the park and just so we can just really fly. My truck broke down about every other day on this trip. I was really close to having a brand new truck by the time we got home.
Oh, wow.
Just because I replaced everything.
Everything.
You know, the radiator cracked just as we hit the Utah desert. It was like 110 degrees. You know, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, so it was an adventure.
Yes, that does sound like an adventure. You know,
the one place we stayed, we had a hard time finding a place. And it's like, okay, well, here's cabins, and they rent cabins. And they've got one. So we check in and we go up there, and not realizing that we had rented the honeymoon cabin. So it's like a hot tub and one big bed. And it's like, well,
which one of us is sleeping on the floor?
Well, it was a big bed. Yeah. And I was like, okay, you know what? I ain't sleeping on the floor. Yeah, he wants to sleep on the floor.
So you hug
like,
it then, I'll hug the other
you
side.
You stay on your side, I'll stay on my side. You know, but yeah, it was a great trip. And just being able to see it, you know, go to Whitebird Canyon.
I think you should write another book on your adventures to research this book.
Oh, yeah. I've thought about doing that because I have, like, every time I go anywhere.
Yeah.
It's like that.
Something happens.
Yeah.
Makes me worry about you going home tonight.
Me too. I think that's why my wife was so worried about me coming over here. She's like I said, I hadn't even made it to Newcastle, and she was, like, calling me. I think you need to turn around. I'm like, oh, I'll be fine, honey.
All right. I've got another question.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
About a style that you used in writing, and that was wrapped around the use of curse words. One of the interesting things, Nancy, when he does the curse words is he doesn't actually use the whole word. It's like the first letter.
And
the last letter, and then like dashes
symbols
or something.
And
in between.
Dashes. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
No, just dashes.
Just dashes.
Just
dashes in between. And what was your, is that an actual style that was used in the 1800s?
Yeah, I've got a book that was published in 1883, I think. It's like Tales of Daring by the Blue and Gray, you know. And I bought that at an auction when I was like 12. Well, my dad bought it at an auction when I was like 12.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he didn't explain to me, just like, okay, at some point you have to stop bidding. I ended up paying like $150 for this book.
Oh, gosh.
You know. But anyway, but that was how they did the cursing in that.
Interesting.
And I thought, well, that is, and at the time I was like, that is really, really cool, you know? And then most of my friends and all that are from church now. And so, you know,
mindful of,
yeah,
especially like, if it's a younger person reading and hasn't quite decided their life.
Right? Yeah. Well, and it's like the first book I wrote, there was a lot of profanity in it, but it was like a dystopian satire.
Mm-hmm.
Very weird, like a Monty Python meets Quentin Tarantino kind
of. Oh, wow.
Strange.
That's
thing.
A combination.
Yeah, it was weird. But anyway, and that was one of the things I was like, there's a lot of cursing in there. It's like, well, these are not nice people, you know? And it's like, and it's the same thing here. It's like most of the book is centered around men doing manly things. And that's what men doing manly things do.
Yeah.
You know, throughout history. And so I thought, you know what, that's a nice compromise. And most of the people that I know are, and I think most people who read Westerns are older and more conservative. And
so for that audience,
yeah, you know, and I thought, well, this is a good way to deal with that, where I can kind of be true to it. If you know, if somebody is like me and like spent time in the military, they're going to know what these people are saying.
Right. Right.
And if that sort of thing offends you, offends people, they can just skip over and it's like, oh, he's saying a naughty word.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know? And so I thought that was a good compromise. That would be, since it was written allegedly by the main character in a jailhouse memoir, mm-hmm. it would be appropriate, you know, especially if he had like had it, sent it to a printer and had one printed, you know, which was,
yeah.
So
very intentional that use. Interesting.
Yeah. And I grew up reading old books and, you know, Charles Dickens and stuff like that. And so it's like, I always loved the little summaries of chapters at the beginning, you know, it's like in which blah, 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 blah happens, you know, and stuff. And I just always loved that stuff. And I wanted to write a book like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
All right. So you mentioned that you had another book. Mm-hmm. Let's take a moment and you can share about either maybe both, but your previous book and then any new projects that you may be working on. Do you have anything new that you're developing?
I've got about six ideas rambling around. One of the problems that I run into is it's really hard for me to start something else until I'm just done with the one I'm working on. And I still haven't given up on this one. So I'm still trying to figure out
how to market it.
Yeah. All that crap. And so, but I've got
all that C-P
stuff. Yeah. And so, oh, that was one of the interesting things that, I'm sorry to just go off on another tangent. Like I said, I was writing this in my MFA program. And so one of the words that I didn't do that to was the N-word. Mm. Because at that time, that wasn't a bad word. And I knew it would like set people off, but it should, mm-hmm. you know, and I wanted people to think about, why is he not doing that? And it didn't fly real well in workshop.
I bet.
They were like, you can spell all the rest of them, but why, you know, don't spell that one. It's like, and I showed them an article that I had looked up, or not an article, but a recipe from a newspaper in the 1950s for a kind of candy that had that, you know, inward toes, you know, and it's like, this was from the 1950s,
yep.
you know, so back then it wasn't seen as a bad word, you know,
unless you were African-American.
Yeah.
And then it was hurtful.
Yeah.
I can see your quandary there, because you're trying to be true to the concept that he's writing it himself and using the style of the times, mm-hmm. and the style of the times would have done that to the official curse words, but mm-hmm. this one was not yet considered.
Wasn't considered that.
So he wouldn't have done that to that one. And it would be more shocking in an appropriate way, probably to the reader, mm-hmm. To see the full word.
Yeah, yeah. And that was something that, because one of the things I wanted to do with this was make people think, because most people, I think most Americans have a very rose tinted view of our history, mm-hmm. you know, based on John Wayne movies and
limited
and Louis L'Amour novels and things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of stuff in the book in which those elements don't show well.
Right.
You know? And so, like I said, I wasn't really writing so much specifically about what happened to the Cheyenne or the Nez Perce or the small ranchers or anything like that, but just kind of trying to draw a line and not to compare what the Cheyenne and Nez Perce went through with the small ranchers and stuff like that, but just to show kind of there's a direct correlation, I think, between how those in power have historically always treated those who don't have power in America. You know, whether it's Chinese railroad workers or slaves or Native Americans or, you know, little guy, you know, little ranchers or, you know, small manufacturers and things like that. They've always got dumped upon from a great height. Mm-hmm. You know, the small ranchers were great as long as they were
pushing
the Native Americans off the land. But as soon as the land was clear, then the big ranchers are like, oh,
yep.
You know.
It's ours now, yeah.
Yeah, and so, yeah, as soon as you stop being useful, away with you, you know? And so that's kind of what I was, and I was just trying to make people think about that, you know, and preferably an entertaining way.
Right.
You know, kind of a little subversive, I guess.
So with all of that and understanding all the research and the intention, do you tend to be what they call them, a plotter or pantser? Pantser is ones who just start writing, or do you kind of organize out the direction you're going to go with the story?
This one was a lot of, I plotted the transitions.
Okay.
Trying to figure out, okay, how do I get this guy from, you know, the Nez Perce reservation after the war to being a deputy sheriff in Wyoming? You know,
yeah.
Plus he's got like after the Nez Perce War, he's got kids to raise still.
Yeah.
So he's got to get through that. And it's like, well, raising kids is a difficult anyway, but
it's an adventure.
And when you're dealing with one that's full blooded Nez Perce and one half blooded, you know, half blooded Nez Perce, then that's going to be that half that mixed blooded kid is going to be, he's going to have some issues.
Yeah.
Complicated relationships.
Yeah. And so I thought that was a good opportunity to kind of explore that briefly, you know, trying to do it so that it's not heavy, because I have a tendency to be a little heavy handed. I don't know if you noticed that. Hopefully you didn't.
Oh, surely not.
Okay.
Shirley's in this book.
Yeah. Shirley's not in that book.
Yeah. So that, you know, there's that.
So you plot those transitions get him where you wanted to be.
How do I get him from being a soldier, you know, because like the first part.
A miner, a rancher, a soldier. Yeah. All that.
The first part is basically, it's like the all-American cowboy dream.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then the Civil War comes along and he's fighting for freedom, you know, fighting to free the slaves. And like, because he doesn't like how his friend, Dave, who is a former slave, is always treated, or how Dave has to behave, even though he's, you know, technically not a slave anymore.
Right.
Or technically is still a slave, but you know,
how some other people treat him
and how they treat him and just the things that Dave has to balance. You know, he's trying to teach Dave to read, and Dave's best friend is trying to stop Nate from teaching Dave to read because he's afraid it'll get Dave killed.
Yeah.
You know, and so all that kind of stuff. I just thought it was really, and all this comes about because he's an outsider. He doesn't know any better.
It's just about time to transition to the random question box, but let me just say this. As I read through the book, I loved the main character, Nate Luck, which is short for, how do you say his full last
look? As far as I know,
it's Lukianov or something like
that. Anatoly Lukianov.
Lukianov. So Nate Luck is the main character, and obviously he's through the whole book. And you have this Esme character who comes and goes through the story. I love that. And you have some of his friends who show up and disappear and show up and disappear. And then you have the villain who comes and goes and just always seems to be there to really just drive him crazy and then gets away. I loved how you kept those threads going through the story, despite all the transitions that Nate had to transition through. So good job.
Oh, thanks.
Very good job.
I'm very intrigued now. We had talked about it. I said, yeah, I'll have to read that one.
Because the bad guy, he's based on three different historical figures, you know? And so I just thought, I'll just make him one guy because they all shared a lot of characteristics. They were all bad guys, you know? But the thing of it is, like, there weren't a lot of people in the Old West. So, and they would intersect frequently just because of there are only so many population centers. Right. And it's like, oh, I need to go to town. There's only one town within 100 miles. So, you know,
right.
So that helped a lot. You know, I thought I can do this without it being too coincidental, you know, or within the realm of possibility anyway.
Well, let's do the random question box. All right,
we got a box with a whole bunch of new random questions in them. So out of this box, Lloyd's going to pick one and then he's going to read it out for us. You have to answer it. Sorry if it's not one you don't like. Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah,
and then Mike and I will answer too.
If you were hiring someone to write your biography, what would the three most important criteria be? Wow. That's a terrible question. I'm like, they'd have to be a really good liar. You
know, to write your biography.
He wants his biography to be historical fiction.
Yeah, that's a lily that needs a lot of gilding. You know, but they would. I don't know. I've never even thought about that. Every time
I would like them to be a good writer.
That would be good. Yes,
I think all right, would.
You got one there.
Yeah.
The liar thing doesn't count?
No. Oh.
They'd have to be a little weird.
All right. I can go for that.
Yeah. You know. And hopefully they would have kind of a wide range of interests. Because I like to think that I have a wide range of interests. Even though it almost all, everything that I do kind of revolves around stories and books and movies and TV and music and stuff like that. But it covers a lot of ground. I'm not really into like one genre or the next. I like kind of all kinds of genres. On my iPod,
yeah.
I've got.
Yeah.
And so
I think, want to make sure that writer doesn't write you one or two dimensional. You want to be able to capture all of.
Well, I think that's the most interesting thing about me, really, because I'm really not that interesting, but I do. I read a lot of interesting books. I listen to a lot of really interesting music. You know, I watch a lot of really interesting movies and things like that. And so I think somebody would have to like understand that to kind of get where I'm coming from.
Right.
And how I ended up like this.
Mike, how about you? What are three aspects you would look for if you were hiring someone to write your?
Well, I think they need to be a really good liar. I think I stole that from someone.
Stop.
No.
They'd also, number four, they'd have to work cheap.
Yeah, there you go. I think, I like the first one, the one you said, they need to be a good writer. I think they need to be well-rounded spiritually, I think, to be able to grasp that part of my life and how it's affected me and transitioned me over the decades. And then I think,
three characteristics. You got to hire him today. Listeners, think about what would you want? What would you be looking for if you were hiring a writer to write your biography?
I think that my third one was, you said listeners in the middle of my thought process.
Sorry.
And I think that actually helped. I think, he would need to be a good listener, or he or she would need to be a good listener, mm-hmm. so that they would catch details that are important. So I off the top of my head, I think those are the things that I'm thinking. How about you, Nancy?
I think I would agree with you guys, somebody who's a good writer, because if anybody's going to read the story about me, you would want it to be written well so that they'd like to read it. I think I would like to know that they're interested in me. Just as much as Lloyd has such a historical interest and, you know, did all the research and dive in. If you're going to write about me, I want you to know that you kind of care. You're a little bit vested in who I am.
It's not just a job. It's something that you actually care about.
Yeah. They're interested in. I think that would be important. Would make me different than, let me just write a story about anybody. Why would anybody want to know a story about Nancy DeCamp? Right.
Well, if they have any sense, they would.
Yeah. Good answer. We're still married.
Was that two or is that the third one? I think that was just two.
Was that just two? Third one? I would think I would like them to be good at marketing.
So you can help it be sold. There you go.
Or have the connections.
There you go. Lloyd, where can people find a rare and dangerous beast?
You can find it online just about anywhere. Like, I mean, Walmart, Target, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. there are a couple of, if you live in Connersville, there is a used bookstore there. I think it's called A to Z Books. They actually have physical copies. And then the Hyde Brothers in Fort Wayne has a few copies. And actually the Three Sisters bookstore in Richmond has some copies. But also, I've got a website that I just started up before that holiday thing.
Yeah.
Through like the Square, the little gizmo for taking credit cards and stuff like that.
Right.
I got like a store through them. And they, so you can do order directly from me. They're kind of discounted. And I autograph them.
Oh, nice.
There free. You go.
So, you know,
yeah,
that would be.
And you do, obviously you did the Christmas gift and hobby show for Mike. Do you, plan on doing more, kind of craft book fairs, things like that, or still to be determined?
Yeah. Cause I'm pretty sure. I mean, it's like going into that thing. I mean, that was one of the things I tried it because I had no idea whether it would work or not.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure I didn't sell enough to pay for the gas to get to Indianapolis three times. So it's like, oh,
is it worth it? You do have to weigh those things out, right?
Well, you know, they say you got to spend money to make money.
You do, and but you can't spend all your money.
I've mastered the first part, you know, and I'm still waiting on that second part to kick in. Yeah, I got to sell a lot more books just to pay for the books that I bought.
Right.
To write it. And for that research trip and all those auto parts.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got to sell a lot of books just to break even on this turkey.
Yeah.
So, I might, you know, and also it's like, okay, I got like one book that's marketable at all. And that's this one, you know? And so I think it works better for, you know, people like yourself who've got multiple books, and I know series are very popular. And
I remember the days when I only had one book.
Yeah.
And I remember going to an event and sitting there all day and selling two books.
Yeah.
It takes a little while. And it does help when you have more than one.
Yeah.
It also helps if you're at an event where people are expecting to buy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's the Christmas gift and hobby show. People are expecting to buy some things most of the time. I've been some at some places where people, you know, we set up a table and they didn't come there for that. You know, they're at, it's a coffee shop and they're there to buy coffee, not a book.
Right.
And so they're just like, what are you doing here? I think partnering, when you have one book, it's good to partner with someone else who has a couple of books. That way you've got enough attention to draw people in. And then I, you know, I listened to you talk about your book and you actually articulate it very well to people,
which is important.
And I loved how you explained it and you captivated them. And you did a really good job.
Because if you can write the best book in the world, you could create the most phenomenal technology in the world. But if you cannot articulate to people the value or the interest, it's going to sit there by itself. So
yeah,
keep it up.
I intend to. I'm like I said, one of the ideas that I've got, cause I don't really want to get into like writing series. Just,
yeah,
there are series that I love, you know, but it's just not something I want to do. I like telling different kinds of stories. And one of the things that I'm thinking about doing is writing one about Nate's kids.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
You know, and maybe get them.
There's a lot of fodder for that, right?
Yeah,
there.
Well, and like, you know, his son would be too old to fight in World War One, I think, but old enough to be involved somehow.
And live through that time frame.
Yeah, and then
impact.
Well, and also I'd like to get into like some of the, like the Union Wars, I think would be interesting and kind of on along the same theme as this.
Yeah.
But you know, a completely different kind of book, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
You know, and I think the idea of having a female Nez Perce doctor at the turn of the century would be interesting as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe, you know, she could go to France for the First World War or something like that,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So lots of fodder there.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff to do there. And then it's like, I'm thinking it's like the next book I want to write, the next thing I write, I want it to be something that requires no research that I can just make it up because I like,
well, then you got to get away from historical fiction.
Yeah.
Just write fiction. Cause you know that, and you need to go modern day cause then you don't have to worry about being historically accurate.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, when I've wrote my books, it's like, okay, I went total fiction and fantasy, so I could say and do and create whatever I wanted to create, and I put it in a part of the country that I know, so I didn't have to go. I don't have to do a lot of research. Maybe go drive through the area and see what's there, that kind of thing. So if you want to do no research, then you're gonna have
there
to
you
do
go.
That.
So that's right now. I'm looking at It's like I don't want to say I want to write a cozy mystery.
A cozy romance. You can do a cozy romance.
Well, sort of, but I want to write. Well, that's the thing.
One you could sell and then draw goals, people into your historical
one
books.
One of my goals is to write something that will actually sell. but I think kind of like a subversive counter cozy kind of thing, because that's the way my brain runs. You know, something that looks and sounds like that, but is actually this.
You could partner up with, what's the guy that was doing the serial killer books that was with us. I'm drawing a blank on his name right now. I know him really well, but I can't think of his name, but he could do a cozy serial killer.
Yeah. Oh, hey. So tell us, say the name again and author so people know.
Okay, folks, the book is A Rare and Dangerous Beast, which basically is a pseudonym for freedom, I think. So A Rare and Dangerous Beast, a novel written by Lloyd Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S. What's your website?
My website is moonsthoughts.com is my blog. And I can't remember what the sales site is, but I know that if you go to my blog, there's a page for the book.
Okay.
And there's a link there.
Okay.
It's like Moonsthoughts.
Moonsthoughts.
When I was in the Air Force, my nickname was Moon.
Okay.
The last name Mullins. If your name's Mullins and you're in the military, chances are they called you Moon, at least up through my generation.
That's interesting.
That's from the old Moon Mullins comic strip.
Yeah.
But,
that's before my time.
Yeah,
it was before mine too, but you know,
but it was part of that.
But Nancy knew what it was.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so do one of the, I'm sorry. Like one last, when I, like I said, I was writing this for my MFA program, and this was the, like the original title, and I had to change it for my MFA program. So I was like, oh, titles are hard. So I called it To Be Free, The Life and Times of Nate Luck, which was okay, but I just didn't like it. I thought A Rare and Dangerous Beast was more interesting.
Yeah.
But the reasoning was because it sounds too much like a Harry Potter book.
Yeah.
Like I didn't already hate Harry Potter enough. You know, I was like, what the heck? So like, well, after I graduated, I was talking to a friend. He's like, you're done with the course. You passed. Call it what you want. I'm like, hey,
okay. Yeah.
So
good friend.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah. So
I like the name of that. And I like the way that it's tied to.
Yeah. And well,
representative of.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, about three pages in, you find out what it is.
Right.
So,
right.
But I thought it's kind of intriguing. I was hoping.
Yeah.
All right. Your website is moonsthoughts.com.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
All right.
So moonsthoughts.
So check it out. Check it out. Especially if you like historical fiction. I know I do.
And Lloyd, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. It's like any opportunity to talk about this book.
Yeah.
I love, because my wife is really tired of talking about
that. So we're saving your marriage tonight. Oh yeah. Right?
That poor woman. She had to read it like five times, you know.
Bless her.
Yeah.
And she liked it. I've only read Mike's books, each one once.
And she liked the last one really well.
I love the last book.
Thanks, Lloyd, for being on this episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast. Thank you, Bill Whitehair,
for being our
post-production editor extraordinaire. And folks, we will see you again next time when we come back. And I think all things go well, we'll have another local author.
Great.
So
looking forward to it.
We will catch you all next time around. Take care, folks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast. Your hosts have been Michael and Nancy DeCamp. Michael is the author of several fantasy thriller novels and short stories that can be found on Amazon or ordered through your local bookseller. Visit www.authormichaeldecamp.com to learn more. His most recent release, The Purveyor of Death, Doc Moon Book 1, is a classic young adult horror novel and the first book in a new series. It's guaranteed to keep you turning pages. Nancy is Michael's number one fan with a love and appreciation for creativity everywhere. The Cutter's Notch podcast is available through most podcast listing providers. Subscribe to catch each new episode as it drops. You can reach us by sending an email to michael@authormichaeldecamp.com. Join us again on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast.